2 in Haiti, and we don't have much time.
Yes, thank you so much. Actually, right now we are in the middle of a major uprising. We are worried that we might end up with a bloody massacre. In one side, we have the opposition and a lot of people in the diaspora in U.S. Congress stating that based on the Constitution, the president should have left on Sunday, February the 7th. The president is saying no, his term ends next year. So right now, we are asking for protection. Those deportation cannot still continue to happen in the middle of a major crisis in Haiti. As you mentioned, we continue to see over and over the neglect, the lack of respect for life on both sides. So we are asking for that to be stopped.
Gerline Joseph, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. And again, Democracy Now! Will be live streaming the Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump, gavel to gavel, starting at 1 Eastern time today. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wearing a mask is an act of love. Where to?
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties will all move from extreme to high COVID risk classification on Friday. State lawmakers consider a bill that would ban sit-lie ordinances. And former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial begins today. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kopanoglu. The Portland metro area counties will soon move out of Oregon's extreme risk level classification for COVID-19 for the first time since November. Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties will instead be classified as high risk. The state's new risk levels will take effect on Friday, February 12th. The high-risk level allows 25% or 50-person capacity indoor dining, as well as the opening of gyms, fitness clubs, and indoor entertainment establishments at the same capacity. Counties will remain at these risk levels from February 12th through the 25th. The Oregon Health Authority reported 305 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, the lowest case count since October 19th of last year. This brings the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 147,419. Oregon health officials also reported one new death, raising the state's death toll to 2,024 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Monday with 66, followed by Washington County with 51. There are currently 221 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, including 55 patients in intensive care units. As of Monday, more than 572,000 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. For more information about booking an appointment and vaccine eligibility, you can visit covidvaccine.oregon.gov or call 211 to speak to an operator. Nationally, more than 27.1 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the novel coronavirus. At least 466,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average about 111,000 cases per day, a decrease of 36% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 106.7 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.3 million people have died across the world. A 3.6 magnitude earthquake hit north of Mount Hood Monday night around 9:30 p.m. The quake was reported near the community of Parkdale, which is just north of Mount Hood and about 15 miles south of Hood River. The earthquake had a depth of about 3.6 miles. Hundreds of people reported to the U.S. Geological Survey that they felt light shaking, including residents of Hood River, Mosier, and the Dalles. Lawmakers in the Oregon legislature are considering a bill that would ban sit-lie ordinances, which prohibit people from sitting or lying on sidewalks. House Bill 3115 would prohibit towns and cities from arresting or citing people for sleeping outside when no alternatives are available. Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek, a Democrat and the sole sponsor of the bill, said HB 3115 will largely force cities statewide to comply with the ban. This means jurisdictions looking to ban houseless people from sitting or lying on sidewalks would have another hurdle to clear. Kotek said, quote, "If you can't justify moving folks along because there's not enough shelter, then you have to have a different standard for how you treat them, and from my perspective, that is more humanely." The bill still has to go through committee hearings and multiple votes before it would become law. The legislation also leaves room for interpretation. It demands cities be, quote, "objectively reasonable" when considering new laws aimed at regulating camping or sleeping outside. Joanne Zuhl, executive editor of Portland newspaper Street Roots, said, quote, "One reason why these laws are so contentious is because of the disparity between what people define as reasonable, and that perspective is weighted by whether or not you are experiencing or have experienced homelessness." A potential bill under consideration by the Oregon legislature would increase access to out-of-hospital birth options and midwifery care. Oregon House Bill 2388, sponsored by Representative Rachel Prusak, a Democrat from Tualatin, would require equitable insurance coverage for care in all birth settings, including home births and freestanding birth centers. Oregon currently regulates the practice for three different kinds of midwives, and if the bill is passed, midwives would be allowed to contract with insurance companies. Families would then not have to pay out-of-pocket for out-of-hospital birth services. Alex Ann Westlake, a midwife and director of the nonprofit Our Community Birth Center in Lane County, says there are often cases where someone has insurance, but it does not cover their preferred birthing location. In addition, Westlake says that the bill would especially help women of color, who have disproportionately high rates of birthing complications and unnecessary cesarean sections. Westlake said, quote, "I think that the COVID-19 pandemic and the upsurge of the Black Lives Matter movement have both highlighted why we need equitable access to birth options. Families are seeking birth options outside of the hospital right now to reduce their risk of COVID exposure and to be able to have extra support." The bill also cites data that shows equal access to home births and birth centers leads to fewer cesarean sections and premature births, as well as lower costs to the healthcare system. The bill, HB 2388, is currently under consideration in the House Committee on Healthcare. The historic second impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins today. For more, here's KBOO's Al Kahn.
The second impeachment trial of Donald Trump began today in the U.S. Senate after pretrial briefs were presented by both sides yesterday. At stake is the further political career of Mr. Trump. If convicted, Trump will no longer be allowed to hold public office and will lose all rights and privileges of a former president. Trump is facing a single charge of inciting the January 6th riot and attempted insurrection in the attack on the U.S. Capitol, which left five people dead, including one police officer. Today's proceedings will center on the question of the constitutionality of impeaching a former president, which seems to be the center of Trump's defense. This argument is expected to be countered by the impeachment managers on the grounds that a president would have free will in the last days in office to commit crimes without any accountability. The managers are also expected to call upon the fact that Richard Nixon was scheduled to be impeached after his resignation, which was only avoided by a pardon by Gerald Ford. Today, each side will have 2 hours to present their arguments on this matter, followed by a vote to proceed, which will only require a simple majority. If the vote to proceed passes as expected, tomorrow and Thursday, both sides will begin arguing their cases. Each side will be allowed 16 hours to make their case, with neither side allowed more than 8 hours each day. After Thursday, the trial will be in recess until 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, when senators will be allowed 4 hours for questioning and impeachment managers will be allowed to call for witnesses or subpoena documents. Trump has been asked to testify under oath at the impeachment, a request that his legal team has refused. The question of any other witness testimony is uncertain. However, it is expected that no witnesses will be called. Last will be the final vote for conviction, which would take 2/3 of the Senate, meaning a conviction would require at least 17 Republican senators to vote in favor. For KABU News, I'm Al Khan.
During the first day of former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, gave an emotional account of the terror experienced by lawmakers and his own family when a violent mob breached the Capitol on January 6. Here's an excerpt of Representative Raskin's speech earlier today.
I want to say something personal about the stakes of this decision, whether President Trump can stand trial and be held to account for inciting insurrection against us. This trial is personal indeed for every senator, for every member of the House, every manager, all of our staff, the Capitol Police, the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, the National Guard, maintenance and custodial crews, the print journalists and TV people who were here, and all of our families and friends. And I hope this trial reminds America how personal democracy is, and how personal is the loss of democracy, too. Distinguished members of the Senate, my youngest daughter, Tabitha, was there with me on Wednesday, January 6th. It was the day after we buried her brother, our son, Tommy, the saddest day of our lives. Also, there was my son-in-law, Hank, who's married to our oldest daughter, Hannah, and I consider him a son, too, even though he eloped with my daughter and didn't tell us what they were going to do. But it was in the middle of COVID-19. But the reason they came with me that Wednesday, January 6th, was because they wanted to be together with me in the middle of a devastating week for our family. And I told them I had to go back to work because we were counting electoral votes that day on January 6th. It was our constitutional duty. And I invited them instead to come with me to witness this historic event, the peaceful transfer of power in America. And they said they heard that President Trump was calling on his followers to come to Washington to protest, and they asked me directly, would it be safe? Would it be safe? And I told them, of course it should be safe. This is the Capitol. Steny Hoyer, our majority leader, had kindly offered me the use of his office on the House floor because I was one of the managers that day and we were going through our grief. So Tabitha and Hank were with me in Steny's office as colleagues dropped by to console us about the loss of our middle child, Tommy, our beloved Tommy. Mr. Nagus and Mr. Cicilline actually came to see me that day. Dozens of members, lots of Republicans, lots of Democrats came to see me. And I felt a sense of being lifted up from the agony. And I won't forget their tenderness. And through the tears, I was working on a speech for the floor when we would all be together in joint session. And I wanted to focus on unity when we met in the House. I quoted Abraham Lincoln's famous 1838 Lyceum speech, where he said that if division and destruction ever come to America, it won't come from abroad. It'll come from within, said Lincoln. And in that same speech, Lincoln passionately deplored mob violence. This was right after the murder of Elijah Lovejoy, the abolitionist newspaper editor. And Lincoln deplored mob violence, and he deplored mob rule, and he said it would lead to tyranny and despotism in America. That was the speech I gave that day after the House very graciously and warmly welcomed me back. And Tabitha and Hank came with me to the floor, and they watched it from the gallery. And when it was over, they went back to that office, Denny's office, off of the House floor. They didn't know that the House had been breached yet, and that an insurrection, a riot, or a coup had come to Congress. And by the time we learned about it, about what was going on, it was too late. I couldn't get out there to be with them in that office. And all around me, people were calling their wives and their husbands, their loved ones, to say goodbye. Members of Congress, in the House anyway, were removing their congressional pins so they wouldn't be identified by the mob as they tried to escape the violence. Our new chaplain got up and said a prayer for us, and we were told to put our gas masks on. And then there was a sound I will never forget. The sound of pounding on the door like a battering ram. The most haunting sound I ever heard, and I will never forget it. My chief of staff, Julie Tagan, was with Tabitha and Hank, locked and barricaded in that office. The kids hiding under the desk, placing what they thought were their final texts and whispered phone calls to say their goodbyes. They thought they were going to die. My son-in-law had never even been to the Capitol before. And when they were finally rescued, over an hour later, by Capitol officers, and we were together, I hugged them, and I apologized, and I told my daughter, Tabitha, who's 24 and a brilliant algebra teacher in Teach for America. Now, I told her how sorry I was, and I promised her that it would not be like this again the next time she came back to the Capitol with me. And you know what she said? She said, "Dad, I don't want to come back to the Capitol." Of all the terrible, brutal things I saw and I heard on that day, and since then, that one hit me the hardest. That and watching someone use an American flagpole with the flag still on it to spear and pummel one of our police officers ruthlessly, mercilessly, tortured by a pole with a flag on it that he was defending with his very life. People died that day.
That was Representative Raskin speaking on the first day of former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for coverage of the second Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, hosted by Mitch Jeserich from Pacifica Radio. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, special programming celebrating KABU's Black history and future. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 31 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 46 degrees. Today in history, In 1942, daylight saving time is instituted by the U.S. Congress. Suggested by President Roosevelt, daylight saving time was imposed to conserve fuel during World War II. The quote of the day is from American politician and civil rights activist John Lewis, who said, quote, "We have a right to protest for what is right. That's all we can do. There are people hurting, there are people suffering, so we have an obligation, a mandate, to do something." An expansion of the number of apprenticeships offered in the U.S. could put more Americans on the path to good-paying jobs. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Apprenticeships could play a key role in placing people in good-paying jobs, especially with high unemployment from the pandemic. An analysis from the Brookings Institution says the U.S. should expand its apprenticeship offerings as the country recovers from COVID-19. Lou Long is an administrator with Northwest Apprenticeship Services based in Salem. She says these pathways provide a way for people to advance their careers quickly.
You went from $16 an hour to $28.80 in 4 years. What other kind of opportunity is there out there that you're going to get a $12 pay increase in 4 years?
Last week, the U.S. House passed the National Apprenticeship Act, which would invest $3.5 billion over the next 5 years to create nearly 1 million apprenticeship opportunities. Annalise Goger is the author of the Brookings analysis. She says apprenticeships are generally thought of as programs for trades such as construction and utilities.
It actually is appropriate for a wide range of industries and various types of jobs, which could range from things like nursing to construction to even technology like software development.
Goger says apprenticeships provide a long runway for people to build skills so they can be competitive in the labor market. It also could be a tool for diversifying industries such as technology. She says most tech companies recruit graduates of the same top computer science programs in the country year after year.
By doing apprenticeship, it gives them a different pipeline to bring people up to the level that they would need for a regular job.
Goger says it's also important that apprenticeships coincide with college credits, which is required in Oregon. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Trump's impeachment trial begins. A former Secretary of State and a GOP congressman have died, and a new VA secretary is confirmed. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are tracking our democracy in historic times.
Is Donald Trump guilty of inciting a violent mob against the United States?
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says that's the, quote, one true question at stake as the former president's second impeachment trial begins today.
Only the fourth trial of a president or former president in American history, and the first trial for any public official that has been impeached twice.
In a defense brief filed Monday, Trump's attorneys painted the case as political theater. However, University of Missouri law professor Frank Bowman says he's not impressed.
They make the arguments that you would expect, which is the claim that the Senate lacks jurisdiction to undertake the trial, that somehow or other Trump's behavior is covered by the First Amendment.
To convict, the Constitution requires the approval of two-thirds of senators present. That means 17 Republican votes, which Bowman thinks is unlikely.
As in some remarkable turn of events, I think we can all be reasonably assured that, unfortunately, acquittal will result.
UC Berkeley law professor John Yoo contends it would be more prudent to charge Trump in criminal court with conspiracy because it's easier to prove than incitement.
President Trump could be subject to prosecution for his involvement in the attack on the Capitol. And if they charge it right, he wouldn't have this defense of free speech behind him as he does, I think, to the House charge.
Senate leaders have agreed proceedings will pause for the Sabbath Friday evening and resume Sunday afternoon. In other congressional news, Alabama Senator Richard Shelby is stepping down after serving seven terms. The 86-year-old is the fourth GOP senator to announce he won't seek re-election in 2022. The Senate confirmed President Joe Biden's pick to head the Department of Veterans Affairs on Monday. Dennis McDonough is the second non-veteran in the role. He served as chief of staff for President Obama and held other national security positions. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell paid tribute to former Secretary of State George Shultz, who passed away Saturday at the age of 100.
America was his country, all right. He loved it deeply, and served it always.
Schultz held four cabinet-level positions, including 6 years as President Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State. And Texas Republican Congressman Ron Wright died on Sunday. The 67-year-old had been battling cancer in recent years and is the first sitting member of Congress to die after a COVID-19 diagnosis. New COVID cases have declined for the fourth straight week, according to CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. The U.S. is stepping up its work to identify coronavirus variants.
We've increased our sequencing about tenfold. So as we look more, we certainly anticipate we might find more.
Department of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is quarantining for 14 days after a member of his security detail tested positive for COVID. Buttigieg has already had one dose of the vaccine and will get the second when his quarantine ends. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Republican Senator Steve Daines of Montana opposes New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland for Interior Secretary, and a bill to extend New Mexico's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force passes through House Committee. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Republican Senator Steve Daines of Montana will seek to block Congresswoman Deb Haaland's nomination to lead the Department of the Interior, the Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
Daines sits on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which will have a first pass at vetting Haaland. Daines says he'll vote against her confirmation, citing her past support of progressive policies on climate change. This could delay Haaland's confirmation, but she's still likely to become the nation's first Indigenous cabinet secretary. Gerald Gray is the chairman of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council. He doesn't want to give the attempt too much oxygen.
Oh, that's just talk. Political speak, that's what that is.
But not all of Daines' Indigenous constituents agree. Tahin Perez is with Western Native Voice, a nonpartisan Indigenous advocacy group in Montana. He's asking Daines to reverse course.
To just see her as a puppet for sort of an agenda is both inappropriate and doesn't take into account how dynamic this individual is.
Haaland's Senate confirmation hearing hasn't yet been scheduled. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
In Maine, the Penobscot's Natural Resources Department is hopeful Congresswoman Haaland will become the next Secretary of the Interior to work on land and environmental issues. Lily Bulkey has more.
John Banks is director of the Natural Resources Department for the Penobscot Indian Nation and a tribal citizen. He says not only does Haaland have experience in fighting for public lands in Congress, but also in business and developing earth-friendly business policies.
That's great. Especially for Indian country, but good news for everybody. So I think she brings a very, very deep commitment to the proper management and development of tribal lands and public lands.
Banks also says her example of bipartisanship in Congress has been critical. She recently helped secure passage of the Great American Outdoors Act and America's Conservation Enhancement Act, legislation to conserve public lands and waters while also expanding access to recreation. I'm Lily Bulkey.
A bill to extend and fund New Mexico's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force passed out of a state House committee Monday. The task force was created in 2019 by New Mexico's governor to study the issue and make recommendations to state leaders and lawmakers. Tribal leaders, community members, women's advocates, and family members of missing and murdered Indigenous people asked lawmakers to support the bill during a virtual meeting.
My name is Valerie Balson, and I represent Forward Together Action, and I'm from the Zuni Pueblo. My family has been affected because our sister was murdered 13 years ago. As family members, we're in a constant state of healing, and I support and I have prayers for the families of the murdered and missing Indigenous women, brothers and sisters out there.
The bill seeks to extend the task force through 2022, fund it with $50,000 through the state's Indian Affairs Department, and declare MMIWR an emergency. A report was recently released by the task force showing the need for data collection, resources, and support for families. Task force members say there's still much work to do, which includes goals for the year to draft policy recommendations in partnership with advocates, tribes, and on the state and federal level. They also plan to collaborate with the Harvard University Native American Program. The bill passed the House State Government, Indian and Veterans Affairs Committee by 8 votes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Sea level rise could threaten coastal nuclear waste facilities. A recent study identified vulnerable sites along the U.S. coast. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Nuclear power is a source of low-carbon electricity, but producing it creates dangerous radioactive waste that needs to be stored safely and permanently. Recent research suggests that as seas rise, some nuclear waste storage facilities are at risk of flooding or storm damage.
We really focused in to say, okay, well, how many plants might actually be subject to these risks?
That's Sarah Jordan of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Her team looked at 13 facilities along the U.S. coast. They found that if seas rise about 6 feet, which is possible by the end of the century, more than half of the waste storage sites would be directly along the water's edge or even surrounded by water. So she says it's critical to anticipate these long-term vulnerabilities and take action.
There are certainly ways that those risks can be managed now.
For example, after 5 years, spent fuel can be moved to dry casks. This is a safer long-term storage method than the cooling pools where a lot of spent fuel is currently stored. So Jordan says it's critical for policymakers to understand the risks at nuclear facilities and create regulations and policies to ensure greater safety. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics, with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's the Children's Hour, educational and entertaining programming for listeners of all ages. Then at 11, it's the Dirt Bag. Host Glenn Anderson talks all things gardening and introduces a new plant of the month. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, with coverage of the opening arguments in the second Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, hosted by Mitch Jeserich of Pacifica Radio.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to coverage
from Pacifica Radio of the Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, who was impeached and thus charged by the House of Representatives for inciting an insurrection and violence at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., as Congress counted the Electoral College vote on January 6th of this year. Today, we will hear 4 hours worth of arguments over the constitutionality of trying a former president after leaving office. Then tomorrow, oral arguments on the actual case begins. To make the opening case, each side gets 16 hours. So tomorrow and the next day, we will hear from the House Democratic impeachment managers. And then the 2 days after that, we will hear from Donald Trump's defense team. And we are anticipating, unless they call witnesses, which at this very moment is not clear they're going to, if they do not call witnesses, we could anticipate this trial wrapping up early to mid next week. I'm your host, Mitch Jezerich, and I'll be with you throughout our coverage of this trial. And joining us as this vote occurs concerning the rules of the trial to sort of talk about and talk us through some of these constitutional issues is Neil Kinkoff. Neil Kinkoff is a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He is the co-author of the book, along with Peter Shane and Harold Bruff, called Separation of Powers Law, Cases and Materials. He was also a former counselor to then-Senator Joe Biden for the impeachment trial of President Bill Clinton. Neil Kinkoff, it is with great pleasure to welcome you back to one of our impeachment shows covering the Senate impeachment trial. Of course, we started having you on this time last year to cover the last one, but thank you for taking time, sir, to join us today.
Well, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for calling me.
Let's try to get into this quickly as we can, because these aren't taking as long as usual votes occur in the Senate, which usually can happen, take up to a half hour. But because everyone, by law, by the Constitution, you're supposed to be in the chamber for a Senate impeachment trial, this vote's going pretty quickly. But what's at play today is whether or not the Senate trial is actually constitutional, considering that Donald Trump is no longer in office. Can you talk me through what that all means?
Well, sure. So President Trump's defenders have cited a provision of the Constitution that says the president, vice president, and all other civil officers shall be removed from office upon impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And they regard that provision, excuse me, as defining the entire scope of the impeachment power. The problem is that's not at all what that provision does. There are other provisions of the Constitution that set out the impeachment power. They're found in Article 1, and they provide that the House has the sole power of impeachment and that the Senate has the sole power to try all impeachments. The provision that President Trump's lawyers are relying on sets out a mandatory penalty. That is, that if you're convicted and you're an officer, you are automatically removed from office. But it doesn't, and it was never intended to define the scope of who might be impeached. It's just that if you happen to be in office at the time you're impeached, you're automatically removed. So the argument is essentially a textual argument that isn't a very good textual argument. If you were to go beyond the text and look at history, it's clear that the impeachment power was always understood as applying to people who are no longer officers. So when the ratifying convention in Philadelphia met in England, they were impeaching Warren Hastings, who had been but no longer was the governor of India. And that case was very much on the minds of the framers. They talked about it a lot. They used it as an example of impeachment and why it is that they wanted to include an impeachment power in the Constitution. So it would be bizarre to think they wanted to include it, but they didn't want to include and apply it to former officers, right? If they had thought that, they would have said so. But they understood that the impeachment power applied to former officers, and they meant to adopt it. And in fact, in our history, it has been applied to former officers. The first impeachment of Senator McClay was of a former senator. And then later, Secretary of War Belknap, during the Grant administration, was impeached after he left office for bribery, and the Senate took a vote on whether it had constitutional authority to try Secretary Belknap, and it voted by a very large margin that it did have authority to try him. So really, there's absolutely nothing to the argument as a matter of law. It's really operating as a political out so that Republicans can vote to acquit the president without having to take a position on the merits.
We're going to have to leave it right there, and you will forgive me for such a short appearance this morning, but we'll come back to you because the trial and the oral arguments are now underway. But Neil Kinkoff, professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, thank you for helping us to get to this point, sir.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right. Again, live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. The arguments over the constitutionality of this Senate impeachment trial in its entirety has begun. Now taking to the podium is the lead House manager for the Democrats, a floor manager for the impeachment, Democrat Jamie Raskin of Maryland.
You will not be hearing extended lectures from me because our case is based on cold, hard facts. It's all about the facts. President Trump has sent his lawyers here today to try to stop the Senate from hearing the facts of this case. They want to call the trial over before any evidence is even introduced. Their argument is that if you commit an impeachable offense in your last few weeks in office, you do it with constitutional impunity. You get away with it. In other words, conduct that would be a high crime and misdemeanor in your first year as president, and your second year as president, and your third year as president, and for the vast majority of your fourth year as president, you can suddenly do in your last few weeks in office without facing any constitutional accountability at all. This would create a brand new January exception to the Constitution of the United States of America. A January exception. And everyone can see immediately why this is so dangerous. It's an invitation to the president to take his best shot at anything he may want to do on his way out the door, including using violent means to lock that door, to hang on to the Oval Office at all costs, and to block the peaceful transfer of power. In other words, the January exception is an invitation to our founders' worst nightmare. And if we buy this radical argument that President Trump's lawyers advance, we risk allowing January 6th to become our future. And what will that mean for America? Think about it. What will the January exception mean to future generations if you grant it? I'll show you.
We will stop the steal. Today, I will lay out just some of the evidence proving that we won this election and we won it by a landslide. This was not a close election. And after this, we're going to walk down and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take the Capitol.
Take the Capitol.
We are going to the Capitol, where our problems are. It's that direction.
We are currently observing video, much of it cell phone video, that was taken on January 6th. the siege of the Capitol as Congress was counting the Electoral College. We've heard this will be a main part of the prosecution by the House floor managers.
The Constitution says you have to protect our country and you have to protect our Constitution, and you can't vote on fraud. And fraud breaks up everything, doesn't it? When you catch somebody in a fraud, you're allowed to go by very different rules. So I hope Mike has the courage to do what he has to do.
So this is a lengthy montage of cell phone video at the Capitol, like as hell, protesters stormed the Capitol along with Donald Trump's speech earlier that morning.
And we're going to the Capitol, and we're going to try and give our Republicans, the weak ones, because the strong ones don't need any of our help, we're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country.
You can now see Trump supporters storming the Capitol, trying to break down a fence that police are trying to hold up, but now it's been broken down. So the House floor managers are showing montages of video along with speeches that occurred on January 6th as Congress was counting the Electoral College vote. And they're giving the chronology of what happened that day on January 6th. Now the caption reads, over 2 hours after insurgents breached the Capitol, President Trump tweets a video.
Such a thing happened where they could take it away from all of us, from me, from you, from our country. This was a fraudulent election, but we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you. You're very special. You've seen what happens. You see the way others are treated that are so bad and so evil. I know how you feel, but go home and go home in peace.
Now the caption reads, at least 7 people lost their lives. More than 140 law enforcement officers suffered physical injuries, and many more have been severely impacted by their experiences that day. 4 hours after the Capitol was breached, Donald Trump tweeted the following. These are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. Go home with love and in peace. That was Donald Trump's tweet. We now return to the lead impeachment House floor manager,
Senators,
Jamie Raskin.
The president was impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives on January 13th for doing that. You ask what a high crime and misdemeanor is under our Constitution? That's a high crime and misdemeanor. If that's not an impeachable offense, then there is no such thing. And if the president's arguments for a January exception are upheld, then even if everyone agrees that he's culpable for these events, even if the evidence proves, as we think it definitively does, that the president incited a violent insurrection on the day Congress met to finalize the presidential election, he would have you believe there is absolutely nothing the Senate can do about it. No trial, no facts. He wants you to decide that the Senate is powerless at that point. That can't be right. The transition of power is always the most dangerous moment for democracies. Every historian will tell you that. We just saw it in the most astonishing way. We lived through it. And you know what? The framers of our Constitution knew it. That's why they created a Constitution with an oath written into it that binds the president from his very first day in office until his very last day in office and every day in between. Under that Constitution and under that oath, the President of the United States is forbidden to commit high crimes and misdemeanors against the people at any point that he's in office. Indeed, that's one specific reason the impeachment, conviction, and disqualification powers exist, to protect us against presidents who try to overrun the power of the people in their elections and replace the rule of law with the rule of mobs. These powers must apply even if the president commits his offenses in his final weeks in office. In fact, that's precisely when we need them the most, because that's when elections get attacked. Everything that we know about the language of the Constitution, the framers' original understanding and intent, prior Senate practice, and common sense confirms this rule. Let's start with the text of the Constitution, which in Article 1, Section 2 gives the House the sole power of impeachment when the president commits high crimes and misdemeanors. We exercised that power on January 13th. The president, it is undisputed, committed his offense while he was president. And it is undisputed that we impeached him while he was president. There can be no doubt that this is a valid and legitimate impeachment. And there can be no doubt that the Senate has the power to try this impeachment. We know this because Article 1, Section 3 gives the Senate the sole power to try all impeachments. The Senate has the power, the sole power, to try all impeachments. All means all, and there are no exceptions to the rule. Because the Senate has jurisdiction to try all impeachments, it most certainly has jurisdiction to try this one. It's really that simple. The vast majority of constitutional scholars who studied the question and weighed in on the proposition being advanced by the president, this January exception, heretofore unknown, agree with us. And that includes the nation's most prominent conservative legal scholars, including former 10th Circuit Judge Michael McConnell, the co-founder of the Federalist Society, Stephen Calabresi, Ronald Reagan Solicitor General Charles Fried, luminary Washington lawyer Charles Cooper, among hundreds of other constitutional lawyers and professors. I commend the people I named their recent writings to you in the newspapers over the last several days. And all of the key precedents, along with detailed explanation of the constitutional history and textual analysis, appear in the trial brief we filed last week and the reply brief that we filed very early this morning. I'll spare you a replay, but I want to highlight a few key points from constitutional history that strike me as compelling in foreclosing President Trump's argument that there's a secret January exception hidden away in the Constitution. The first point comes from English history, which matters because, as Hamilton wrote, England provided the model from which the idea of this institution has been borrowed. And it would have been immediately obvious to anyone familiar with that history that former officials could be held accountable for their abuses while in office. Every single impeachment of a government official that occurred during the framers' lifetime concerned a former official. A former official. Indeed, the most famous of these impeachments occurred while the framers gathered in Philadelphia to write the Constitution. It was the impeachment of Warren Hastings, the former Governor General of the British colony of Bengal, and a corrupt guy. The framers knew all about it, and they strongly supported the impeachment. In fact, the Hastings case was invoked by name at the convention. It was the only specific impeachment case that they discussed at the convention. It played a key role in their adoption of the high crimes and misdemeanors standard. And even though everyone there surely knew that Hastings had left office 2 years before his impeachment trial began, not a single framer, not one, raised a concern when Virginian George Mason held up the Hastings impeachment as a model for us in the writing of our Constitution. The early state constitutions supported the idea too. Every single state constitution in the 1780s either specifically said that former officials could be impeached or were entirely consistent with the idea. In contrast, not a single state constitution prohibited trials of former officials. As a result, there was an overwhelming presumption in favor of allowing legislatures to hold former officials accountable in this way. Any departure from that norm would have been a big deal. And yet there's no sign anywhere that that ever happened. Some states, including Delaware, even confined impeachment only to officials who had already left office. This confirms that removal was never seen as the exclusive purpose of impeachment in America. The goal was always about accountability, protecting society, and deterring official corruption. Delaware matters for another reason. Writing about impeachment in the Federalist Papers, Hamilton explained that the president of America would stand upon no better ground than a governor of New York and upon worse ground than the governors of Maryland and Delaware. He thus emphasized that the president is even more accountable than officials in Delaware, where, as I noted, the Constitution clearly allowed impeachment of former officials. And nobody involved in the convention ever said that the framers meant to reject this widely accepted, deeply rooted understanding of the word impeachment when they wrote it into our Constitution. The convention debates instead confirm this interpretation. There, while discussing impeachment, the framers repeatedly returned to the threat of presidential corruption aimed directly at elections, the heart of self-government. Almost perfectly anticipating President Trump, William Davey of North Carolina explained impeachment was for a president who spared, quote, no effort or means whatever to get himself reelected. Hamilton in Federalist One said the greatest danger to republics and the liberties of the people comes from political opportunists who begin as demagogues and end as tyrants, and the people who are encouraged to follow them. President Trump may not know a lot about the framers, but they certainly knew a lot about him.
That's the head House impeachment floor manager, Jamie Raskin, closing in their arguments that the Senate trial of Donald Trump is constitutional. Its defense team is arguing that because Donald Trump is no longer president, the Senate lacks the jurisdiction in order to try Donald Trump in an impeachment trial. What we've heard so far is about what, maybe an hour and a half of arguments from the House impeachment floor managers who are arguing that it is constitutional. Kind of what is at play in this discussion is what the Constitution says about the impeachment itself. And in Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7, it says that judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than the removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. What Trump's team is arguing, and this is going to be one of their major arguments here on out, is that this is not a constitutional trial, again, as I indicated, because Donald Trump is no longer president. And they are pointing specifically, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office. And they're arguing you can't remove him from office because he is obviously no longer in office. And then I guess the other question is, do you have to fulfill both of these qualifications, removal from office and to disqualify this person from holding any office in the future? Of course, the Democrats and the House Democratic floor managers are arguing that it is still constitutional because the Senate can decide to disqualify Donald Trump from running for office, for a federal office anyways, ever again, which of course is a big issue because it appears even, and it's only a few weeks since he has not been in office, and we'll have to see what the next couple of years holds and stores ahead for us, but it appears that Donald Trump still has a tremendous amount of power within the Republican Party, that the base is still backing the former president, and because he has only served one term as president, he's eligible to run again if he chooses to do so. in under 4 years from now for the election of 2024. I'm your host, Mitch Jezerich. You are listening to coverage from Pacifica Radio of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us.